Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Laura Cunningham. She's an artist naturalist, author, and biologist who also co-founded a conservation organization, Basin and Rain Watch, that works towards saving the California-Nevada deserts. She's the author-illustrator of the extraordinary book, A State of Change, Forgotten Landscapes of California. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
So let's talk about California condors. Can you talk about their range prior to talk about who they are, their ecological function, if we can say that. I'm sorry that word's so utilitarian. And their ecological role, ecological relationships maybe, their traditional range, and then what happened to them.
Yeah, well, California condors are kind of an amazing ice age, like a megafauna that seems almost left over from an era before, you know, European humans overran continents. So I always picture them as something from a past age where, you know, we had mammoths and saber-toothed cats, giant bison, and we had several species of condor back 10,000 years ago. And prior to that, we even had these things called teratorns, meaning terrible bird, that were even larger than condors. And these are all scavenging birds, and they had a important role to play in ecology, where they were the cleanup crew. I mean, when a saber-toothed cat came and killed a native horse or a bison, or dire wolves killed some. The condors, there are many of them. There are probably thousands scouring the skies, say, above the La Brea tar pits. That's where some fossils have been found. And they, for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, they have a really good sense of smell, and they were able to come down and clean up carrion and carcasses. So that's an important role that, you know, turkey vultures in California still do this. But it's a needed ecosystem function to have, you know, the cleanup crew that comes and removes rotting meat and carrion from, you know, our natural predator-prey food chain relationship. So the teratorns went extinct at the end of the Ice Age, but California condors survived, and they continued to play a role cleaning up, say, a coyote kills a ground squirrel, or our native wolves killed a tule elk. They would come and eat the remains of these things, even swallowing some bones, but picking apart the bones clean. That's their role, is to eat carrion. And there were thousands of condors through the last Holocene period, the last 10,000 years. They were worshipped at times by various native California tribes. You know, these huge 11-foot wingspans with stark black and white, you know, very flashy plumage colors. So they're like a magnificent bird that, you know, everyone should get a chance to see them. But unfortunately, when European settlers came, especially during the gold rush, condors took a downturn. I mean, they were just literally shot out of the sky for fun. There were rumors, myths that were not true, that somehow condors would come and kill your calf, you know, your livestock, or carry your sheep away. Just simply not true. So they were unfortunately mercilessly shot, and then lead bullets proved to be their downfall even in the 20th century. I mean, a hunter going out shooting a deer, sometimes the deer would only be wounded and run off into the brush. The hunter couldn't find it. Condors would come down and do what they do, eat the carrion of, you know, the deer might have died later. But ingesting these lead bullets just led to huge problems with the last of the condor population, and they got lead poisoning. And now condors used to range across the West, although their core area are the Southern California mountains, the Peninsula Range, areas east of Santa Barbara, the Los Padres National Forest. And so after this 1800s, 1900s, and the 20th century crash in population, they shrank back to basically this very small area around some wilderness peaks east of Santa Barbara, south of San Luis Obispo, in the interior coast ranges. And that's where the last condors, I mean, it was down to less than a dozen in the mid-20th century. And global population of wild condors was reduced to that few. So that's an introduction to the condor. I mean, the good part of the story is that they, because of this lead poisoning crash in the global condor population centered in California, the agencies did an emergency recovery effort, and they basically netted all the last condors. I mean, literally with a biologist would hide in a hole in the ground. I saw it, and then have a little button that would kind of shoot really minor, like explosives. I don't think they're explosive, but like an air gun type deal, where a net would go over a little calf carcass that would lure a condor. And the biologist would actually sit in this blind waiting for a condor to come and eat the carcass, and then they would be netted. And these were all the last condors were taken out of the wild because the biologists feared that they would just keep ingesting lead bullets and then die of lead poisoning. There's even a push to legislate the use of steel bullets for hunters, and that's had variable success over the years because apparently there's different qualities that hunters like in lead ammunition compared to steel. Steel wouldn't poison condors. So this happened in the 1980s. They captured all the last condors out of the wild, which was controversial at the time, and then bred them in different zoos. They tried to have about three different zoos or raptor breeding programs in case a disease hit one, and they'd have others. And it was actually successful. I'll give them credit. It was kind of controversial at the time to take them all out of the wild, but they successfully bred dozens of chicks, grew them, and then reintroduced them gradually back into their former range. And they also, even, you know, condors live 60, 70 years. They even took one of these male condors, AC9. He had a little wing tag, and I used to watch him. Los Padres National Forest. He had a good run of many years breeding chicks, and then they released him back into the wild. This was maybe 10 years ago, and he's out there, you know, flying again in his former range. I was really happy to see that. So it's become a very successful program of expanding condor ranges now. So it's one of the few heartening stories, unlike, say, salmon, which have just been crashing continuously. But this Ice Age scavenger bird, the California condor, has made a comeback.
So I want to talk more about the breeding program in a minute, but I want to go back to the birds themselves. And I want to tell you two anecdotes, and then I want you to tell me if they're true, and then, you know, do whatever comment you want on them. The first one is, I think I read something the other day that they were tracking a condor or videoing a condor, and it went 100 miles without flapping its wings once, just soaring the whole time. So do you have any stories about that?
Yes, I think that's accurate. I mean, condors are these masters of the air, and they regularly roost in trees and rocks and cliffs, say around Mount Pinos in the Los Padres area, and they'll sun themselves in the morning, and then they can just catch a prevailing wind, and they have been, you know, radio tracked to just fly in a straight line 100 miles across the San Joaquin Valley and then go, say, perch on a giant sequoia in the southern Sierra Nevada. And they're just expert at using the minimum amount of energy. So if they can catch that wind, they can ride it for miles and miles, tens of miles, without having to flap. And they just have micro adjustments of their flight feathers and tail. So they'll fly out 100 miles, search for carrion in the southern Sierras, and then they'll fly back 100 miles back to their roost in one day. I mean, they're just amazing, you know, aerial athletes with minimal energy use.
So the second one, I guess there's three stories. The second story is they're being reintroduced up here in Northern California. The Yurok are doing a lot of work on that. And I read somewhere years ago that one of their specialties back hundreds of years ago was that they were one of the few creatures who could successfully scavenge, especially birds, who could successfully scavenge sea mammals who washed up on shore, like sea lions, because their heads are strong enough, their neck is strong enough that they could break through the skin. And is that true, that they are able to serve that function, or have you heard about that?
Yeah, I think they have a very strong, sharp beak with a, you know, kind of a almost like razor-like edges and a tip that can puncture through skin. So, yes, I mean, there's quite a lot of historical observations of condors on beaches back in the 1800s scavenging seals and sea lions and whales. Of course, back then you had California grizzlies that were definitely able to claw their way into a thick-skinned whale. So, but I think condors have an important function in that respect too, now that we no longer have grizzlies. They're extinct in California. So condors, I'm sure, are able to access some of this thick-skinned carrion, and then that allows other, like turkey vultures, ravens, jays, coyotes, to also come and get a dinner. So that's an important ecological function.
Oh, before we go any further, I just love this little factlet that, can you talk about why vultures, etc., are usually bald?
Yes, because they're actually very clean birds. I mean, people sometimes think a vulture must be filthy because it feeds on, you know, a dead animal. But they are very clean. They preen themselves, and the featherless head allows them to just stick their head into a carcass without dirtying feathers at all. And condors are kind of neat, too, because they have a ruff, it's called, a ruff of feathers, like a collar of long feathers that's usually retracted down next to their body and shoulders. So they have that down when they're feeding to keep themselves clean. And they'll go in next to a pool of water or a river and actually bathe. I mean, they'll bathe their head to clean it further. But this ruff of feathers on a cold morning, they can raise it and it covers their neck all the way up to their head. So they have some interesting adaptions to keeping clean while feeding on, you know, carrion.
So the next story, I don't know if I ever told you this, but it's just one of the coolest things I've seen. Somebody dumped a freezer at a friend's house, and the friend asked me to remove it, to take it to the dump. And there was some meat in there that was really old. This has nothing to do with California condors. It has to do with carrion eaters. So my friend and I popped the top open, and we were pretty overwhelmed by the smell. It was, you know, really, really bad meat. And the point is that literally within 10 minutes, okay, there was nobody in the sky, and within 10 minutes, there was a vulture circling overhead. So let's just think about this for a second. So in 10 minutes, molecules of that meat had to go up into the air and had to go over the horizon. And admittedly, I live in a forest, so there's, you know, there's trees. So it's not like a desert where you can see for 30 miles or whatever. Anyway, so it had to go up in the air, get diffused over literally cubic miles of air, And those molecules have to find their way into the nose of the, or mouth or whatever, of the vulture. And then it had to come there, and that happened in 10 minutes. So the sense of smell must be just miraculous.
That's an amazing story. Yeah, in the 80s when I was condor watching with a group of people, and we were talking with some filmmakers who had been watching them for years before that, and this was before the condors were taken out of the wild and bred, so you had maybe a dozen condors left, and they had a memory going back generations, you know, thousands of generations of behavior. And what we were told and we saw was condors have a very good sense of smell, unlike most birds. Birds, typically, that's not their strong sense. Sight, you know, is the main one. Condors can smell really well, but turkey vultures are the king, the queen of the sense of smell in the bird world. And they just have very open nostrils on their beak, so they don't even have to open their mouth. But they can smell, like you witnessed, the smallest particles of a carrion odor from a great distance. They don't really even use eyesight as much as smell, and this incredible sense of smell they have. So we were told that in ages past, people would see a line of condors soaring, circling, hanging on wind currents along the crest of a mountain range or the coast ranges. And all day they would sort of be hanging out in these currents above the crest of the ranges. And they would be watching the turkey vultures. The turkey vultures would be up there too, circling like they do, catching air currents or thermals. And the turkey vultures would get the carrion smell first and then start to circle downwards. And the condors would watch the turkey vultures and then follow them. So everyone would find, you know, whatever, the deer carcass hidden in brush. But the turkey vultures would be the first at the carcass. So it just makes me think there are probably stories like this that have been lost, because now we have a lot of condors that don't even have that memory of behavior, you know, watch the turkey vultures. So it's almost like they have to relearn things like that. So I'm always an advocate for, you know, trying to not take animals out of the wild, because they have a generational memory of what to do, that it's getting lost more and more with human intervention and development and threats from too many humans.
Well, that would be a really good segue to go back to the reintroduction efforts. But I want to ask something else first, which is, earlier you said something about a coyote kill and a condor eating the remains from that. And that's pretty small. Is it? When I think of condors, when I think of big vultures, I mean big scavenger birds, I normally think of eating a fairly big target. Is it actually worth their effort to come down to the ground to eat a dead ground squirrel, a dead small thing, or do they normally only wait for a big thing?
I think sometimes it is. I mean, they've recorded condors feeding on dead ground squirrels, so apparently it's worth their while because they can gorge on it. And there may not always be a deer, or especially these days, a tule elk, which are so local and uncommon now. You know, and there are cattle and sheep carcasses regularly. But I think they use so little energy to waft down from a high area that I think it seems to be worth their while. And one of the problems that condors have also encountered is when they're down on the ground, walking around, they will pick up bone chips, just little coin-sized white chips of bone, and swallow them. And they're able to digest this and get their calcium. And part of the problem is our human plastic and micro trash, you know, plastic that gets into the environment, and then it breaks apart. And it takes a very long time to really degrade. Condors mistake these plastic chips for bone and eat them. And then they, you know, can't digest plastic, and it overloads their gut, and again, another source of recent mortality.
Oh, one more turkey vulture story that I just remembered, and then we'll go back to the reintroduction. That there was something dead in the meadow here, and I saw one turkey vulture come down, and I don't remember if it landed in a tree or by the body. And the body was bigger than a squirrel. I don't remember what it was, but it was, and it wasn't as big as a deer, whatever it was. Anyway, pretty soon there was a whole family of them, and they, and again, I don't know if this is common or if this was just one time, but they all frankly seemed pretty polite about it. There wasn't a lot of squabbling between them. And I know the first one who got here didn't dive down immediately and start scarfing as much food as possible. It looked like it waited. It was a very interesting, it looked to me like some sort of family situation where they were all pretty content to be sharing. And, you know, I don't want to push that too far, but is this making any sense to you?
You know, I've seen that too. And when we watch, you know, the African wildlife series on TV, you see all these squabbling African vultures, you know, they're diving in and it's quite a fight, a food fight. But I have seen this too with the condors. And it was back in the 1980s, the last couple of wild condors, and they would plant, you know, like I said, the calf from a local rancher as bait. And we sat there with our spotting scopes at quite a distance and binoculars. And you'd have red-tailed hawks, turkey vultures, ravens come in and feast. And then it was a very high density of golden eagles, so there'd be eagles feasting on this too. But when the condor came, condor would fly in, land, and it would open these huge, you know, 10-foot long wingspan, and it flashed that black and white color that they have on their wings, made quite a flash of, you know, it was almost like seeing a police car, I guess, a black and white, and it scared even the eagles off this carcass. And then everyone, all the other birds waited, and a couple of other condors came, and they were all, like you said, very polite. And I think, at least from what I've seen of American vultures and the other raptors, they seem to have kind of a hierarchy of who's going to be eating first. And then when one gets full, it walks away to digest, and another one comes in. So condors seem to have that behavior, at least the few times I've been able to watch them feast in California in the wild. And they were, frankly, able to push golden eagles off of a carcass, and the eagles had to wait. But I've never seen a food fight like in Africa. It just seems to be a different behavior, perhaps, here in the Americas.
So you said earlier that that capturing the wild ones was controversial, and that it was, and can you talk about the controversy and also the process and the costs, by which in this case I'm not meaning financial costs, but especially, like you said, the loss of possible stories told by the vultures themselves to the loss of culture. So can you talk about the controversy and the potential costs and also the potential benefits?
Yeah, the controversy was because a lot of people felt, well, we just need to strengthen our efforts to save condors in the wild. And that's definitely been done. I mean, since the 80s, there have been whole blocks of land purchased, like this Wind Wolves Preserve on the edge of the San Joaquin Valley, to keep just for condor management, you know. But at the time, there were not these giant preserves. The populations were just crashing. I mean, the lead poisoning was hard to control. And so I had mixed feelings about the plan to just capture all of them for a captive breeding program, because I felt like, you know, you are losing this line of behavior that the condors have learned over thousands of years locally. They have this local knowledge and how to interact with turkey vultures, like I was saying. And other people did think that this was the wrong decision. But then when you looked at, you know, the weekly news, and they'd find another condor carcass dead from lead poisoning or some person shooting them for fun, just with a rifle. You just like to shoot things out of the sky. It just became apparent that we really didn't want to just let them die one by one. And the most important factor was the genetic diversity. I mean, that's what leads to a lot of animal extinctions or near extinctions, is they go through a genetic bottleneck. The cheetahs in Africa have had this problem, even tule elk. And when you lose all this genetic diversity, it can make recovery efforts even more difficult, because you're dealing with inbreeding, which can reduce health. So the decision to just try to get all 9 or 10 remaining wild condors out, and then have a very careful breeding program where there were a couple of captive condors already in zoos, and to do a very detailed scientific breeding program where you tried to keep that genetic diversity, maximize it, and then, you know, not let them go through such an intense bottleneck that they could just go extinct from disease or lack of fitness, as biologists say. So I, in the end, thought, yeah, I guess we really do have to do that, capture them all for a captive breeding program. But I mean, the good news is it worked, and now we have an ever-growing population of condors, and quite a lot of them are back in the wild. They're nesting successfully. They're reintroducing them to new areas. I mean, one of the first was the Grand Canyon area, south of the Grand Canyon, where they historically had nested, and that was one of the first reintroduction programs that was a great success. And I was really personally happy to see that. And then they were reintroduced to Pinnacles National Park, and it was a national monument back then, but that proved to be a success too. All these interesting rock formations and cliffs at Pinnacles, perfect roosting and nesting habitat. So that was a success. And then, like you've said, they're trying to reintroduce them to Northern California in the Redwood Zone, and even to Oregon. So I think it was a controversy at the time, but I think the decision was correct, and it's proven to be really good, because the genetic diversity bottleneck that the condors went through, I mean, imagine a population of, you know, tens of thousands being reduced to less than 20 in zoos and in the wild globally. I mean, it's huge. You know, the tule elk, I just learned from watching a webinar by California Department of Fish and Wildlife this week. I mean, the tule elk went from 500,000 in California to two individuals, they think, now. They've really researched this gigantic genetic bottleneck to lose all that gene flow and diversity. So they had to have a really careful breeding program for tule elk right now. When they try to take some elk out of one population that's doing well and then move them to another area of California, they really look at the genetics and try to make sure they're maximizing the genetic diversity. So it was a good decision. California condors seem to be doing really well, so I'm quite happy about that.
So I don't want to get too technical about this, but if you only have two, how, I mean, that means that the children are going to have to, the next generation of breeding is going to have to be siblings. And I mean, I don't understand how you get past that genetic, how does genetic diversity start again from such a small level?
The biologist about the tule elk put it this way. He said these two individuals, they weren't related, so that when the cow and the bull elk bred, they have different genetic lineages. But he said, basically, we were really lucky that we got two excellent, healthy individual elk that could pass on really good genes to the next generation, and then that could keep growing and growing, and you didn't have like some malformed poor elk that wasn't very, you know, healthy or had good genes. I mean, this is biological science, so it's simply that you just want to make sure that you guide, you know, these very rare, almost going extinct species in a good direction. I mean, zoos do this all the time, and I'm not a fan of zoos, but they have helped on occasion where you have a species that almost goes extinct, and you just want to make sure that there's enough genetic diversity. And over time, you know, you get good mutations that help increase that genetic diversity. But yeah, genetic bottlenecks is a term that in extinction science is pretty common, because a lot of rare species get down to where there's not enough genetic diversity and they go extinct just because of like inbreeding, like a brother and sister breeding, and then they just are not healthy.
Like the Habsburgs.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a good example. Yeah.
So can we go back again to what was the pre-conquest range of the California condor? You mentioned it in passing, but you didn't really define it.
It was a huge area of Western North America, still centered in California. Apparently California just had the core population, but they went up to Oregon, Washington, slightly into Canada. They went almost to the Great Plains. I mean, their range was more Pacific coastal states. I've seen a couple of references to some in Nevada. They weren't that common in the Great Basin. I mean, they definitely preferred the abundant, rich Pacific Northwest and California salmon streams, beaches, you know, big herds of tule elk, Roosevelt elk. I don't know why they weren't really in the Great Plains. That's maybe it was winters were too cold. I mean, they might have benefited from pretty mild winters. And then they went down to Mexico, so they had a huge range. And they even went occasionally out into the desert, like the Southern California deserts, but they were mostly a grassland and forest and woodland bird.
And what would be an individual family's... Okay, two questions. What would be an individual either bird or family unit's range? Do they pass those ranges on to generations? And are they social? Do they hang out in a family, or do they come together and breed and then they never see each other again after the babies are born? Or how does all that work?
Yeah, they're actually very social. I mean, they have these roosting areas where you can, I mean, I think prehistorically you would have seen dozens roosting in a tree or a rock cliff. So, and I think they must recognize each other and their familial relations. And, you know, a pair of condors both help take care of the chick and build the nest. So they're pretty monogamous, although they will change mates. I don't know if they mate for life, but they're certainly, you know, choose the male and female will help raise their chick. The chick goes off and, you know, fends for itself, so it's not like they stay in a family all their life. But I think prehistorically they must have had quite a social organization. I mean, because they're hanging out and nesting in the same place over thousands of years, so there's probably a more complex social structure than we even know. But here's an interesting story too. There have been gay condors. So biologists have recorded known male condors and perhaps female condors that form a pair, like two male condors form a pair, and they'll build a nest together. And of course, they can't lay an egg. But I thought that was a really interesting find that, you know, there can be gay animals. It's not just a human thing. I mean, other condors apparently have this behavior too.
Well, and there's a book on this called Biological Exuberance that catalogs homosexual behavior in lots and lots of species. It's pretty interesting stuff. So what about, here's another question I have, is that let me know if this concern is unfounded, that whenever I think about vultures, I always feel bad because there aren't as many wildlife to die. And oftentimes, you know, there may be cattle out there, but for the most part, they don't end up dying outside. They end up dying in a slaughterhouse. And You know, when we have a pet dog, we don't normally set that out for a scavenger. And instead, we cremate it or bury it. And humans, for the most part, aren't being left out. So my point is that, and let me know if I'm completely wrong on this, but it seems that with the collapse of wildlife populations in general, that this must be a really bad time to be a scavenger.
I think that is founded. I mean, I think that is sad. I think picture 500 years ago. I mean, people would see a herd of 1,000 tule elk in the Sacramento Valley. There were pronghorn antelope. There were gray whales dying on the beaches. There's huge amounts of carrion. And the bison, 100 million bison in the Great Plains. And we've replaced that with, like you said, cattle and sheep, other livestock that we mostly harvest away from their range land and process. So the only remaining carrion for the vultures and condors is like a stillbirth calf or, a sick cow that the rancher doesn't find and dies. So I think we have taken away a huge amount of food resources for scavenging birds and coyotes and other animals.
Well, let's do the math. I think that there were, so if we say that there were 100,000 tule, how many tule elk were there?
500,000.
Okay, 500,000. And how long do they live? 10 years, say? 5 years?
Yeah, 10 years.
Okay, 10 years, which means 50,000 per year are dying, which means that there is 160 per day are dying just of old age. And that's a lot of food that is now no longer there. And of course, it's not all eaten by condors. Of course, it's eaten by wolves and by bears and everybody else. But that's still, we know about this with the salmon. You know, there were millions of salmon came up and they're gone and the forests are starving. And you mentioned salmon before. Did the condors eat salmon too?
Yeah, that's why I think condors were abundant along the whole Pacific coast. I think salmon are probably one of their main prey items in the past that's kind of not really talked about. I mean, just consider thousands of salmon running up these big rivers and every coastal creek far into the Sierras and the Cascades. And then they, unlike steelhead trout, the salmon die. They spawn, lay eggs, and then they die. And this was a gigantic, I almost think of it like a natural fertilization of ocean fish into the forests and the grasslands in California. I mean, steelhead went all the way down to Los Angeles. They didn't die, but they sometimes did. But this huge resource of dying, millions of dying salmon along these rivers and streams, I think was a gigantic food resource for grizzlies, every carnivore, but especially vultures and condors. So that's why I'm really happy that I hope to see condors more in, say, Redwood National Park and the Pacific Northwest, feeding on our small remnant salmon populations. And it makes me wish we could recover salmon as well as we have condors.
You know, I think you and I probably, I think one of the many, many, many ways we agree would be that I am not a purist. I don't actually care how a species recovers as long as it recovers. So I don't particularly care. I mean, I'm not a big fan of zoos either, but I don't have a problem with captive breeding programs as long as they work. And there are one of the arguments. I mean, first off, I'm presuming you agree with that, right?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So one of the arguments I've heard against it, though, is that the money would generally be better spent on preserving habitat, because if you rehabilitate the animal, but there's not decent habitat for it, then you're still, it still is not going to work.
And that's a really good point. I mean, I totally believe we should be spending much more funds and people power in preserving large chunks of natural habitat, and that includes habitat that's just not like overgrazed or, you know, farmed somehow or polluted or, off-road vehicle to death, you know, but very natural habitats. I think that is equally necessary. And I still agree, though, zoos can have a definite need for like these genetic programs where they have huge computer software algorithms now that analyze the genes of, say, Thule elk. And then they have kind of like a breeding program where they make sure that that female elk should mate with this herd to maximize, you know, the good genes. But yeah, habitat to me, I mean, that's why I'm happy that President Biden has embraced this 30 by 30 program, preserve 30% of public lands, maybe even private lands by 2030. I think the devil's in the details there, but I'm happy to see that kind of push finally.
You know, when I started to bring up this thing about spending money on habitat versus spending money on the breeding program, I remembered a conversation that I had with Chris Tompkins about this, about a plan to, about work that her organizations have done to reintroduce giant anteaters in South America. And she made the point that the question really depends on what the bottleneck is, not genetic bottleneck, but what the threat is. And in the case of giant anteaters, she said, the problem is not habitat. The problem has been killing. And so they've even just taken giant anteaters that were kept in like appalling private zoo, tiny conditions and released them into the wild. And that has been one more giant anteater in the wild because I've already said this, but the problem isn't habitat. And so if there still is enough food for them to eat, the problem would have just been, like you said, the lead and the numbers, which means it's the best thing, as opposed to if you still have, there are many creatures who, there are still a fair number of the creatures, but they don't have any habitat, and so they are going to eventually dwindle. And in their case, you got to go for habitat. It would be, desert tortoises is a great example. I was talking to a guy about them who said that the problem with desert tortoises is not any sort of genetic collapse. The problem is that all their habitat's being taken. And since you love desert tortoises, was he right on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the destruction and degradation of the Mojave Desert is definitely what's killing tortoises right now. I mean, they're still relatively common and widespread, so there's no genetic bottleneck happening. But yeah, the destruction for energy projects and off-roading and urbanization is huge. You know, and I was just talking with or saw a very good talk by, you know, each species is so different. A scientist studying Egyptian tortoises, and just really quickly, Egyptian tortoises have a completely different threat. They're common relatively still, although crashing in population. Their habitat has some urbanization along the coast in Egypt, but their main threat is over collecting for the pet trade. And he was able to get the local tribal people in the Sinai Peninsula to start helping study and look at the behavior and pay them to do this instead of collect them and box them up for the pet trade. So yeah, each species has a different threat and a different, you know, way to recover them.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and can you tell us whither the California condor?
Well, it's doing well, and I'm really happy, but it's almost a human, or perhaps I should say an American weakness, that when things are going pretty well, we have to sort of mess it up again. And one thing I've been concerned about for California condor management is a new utility scale giant wind project, a wind power project, is proposed for the Manzana Hills, which is sort of near the Tehachapi Pass, Highway 58 area in Southern California. And this is troubling because the wind developer knows they're building this, you know, 400-foot-tall wind turbines in really close to the core of California condor habitat and range and nesting areas, and they've mapped them out. And so instead of not having a wind project right next to the core area of condors, they've contacted the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is responsible for recovering the condor, and say, well, just give us a take permit, meaning, you know, if we accidentally kill a condor, you know, we won't get fined or sent to jail, but we'll mitigate it. And so, unfortunately, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is going to give this company an incidental take permit under the Federal Endangered Species Act to take, I can't remember how many condors, not too many, but over a 30-year period. They'll be allowed to kill, basically. They'll get a kill-for-free card from the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the mitigation is, well, we'll, you know, have observers out there. We'll try to curtail the wind turbines, make them spin less or stop if condors are in the area. And then we'll breed them. We'll say, okay, we'll fund one of those captive breeding programs to just breed more condors that we can throw back out here so that we have no net loss. But what angers me about that is, okay, we've already degraded their habitat and put these giant chopping machines up in their fly zones. I mean, condors cannot see, and other eagles, this has been an eagle problem, they can't see these spinning rotors, the tip of which can be going 100 miles per hour. So instead of stopping this problem, we're just going to mitigate it forever, and that'll draw other wind developers, and we're creating a new problem for condors.
It's madness.
So
is that a done deal?
It looks like it is. I mean, I wrote comments opposing this, but it looks like it'll, you know, this is the trouble. I'm completely for renewable energy. I mean, I know I'm actually more with you, really, in a realistic way. Our human need to have technology to fix things is just madness to me. But if we're going to have renewable energy, it should be done responsibly. And apparently we're just not going to do that.
Yeah, I'm not convinced it can be done responsibly, but in any case, that's even worse to put
I actually agree with you, but you know, my tactic is to at least try.
Right.
You know, somebody's got to tell them, just don't put a wind project right there.
So how many condors are in the world, right? California condors are in the world right now, and how many are in the wild?
You know, I didn't look that up. I'm not sure the exact numbers. I mean, I can Google that really quickly, but there's a lot more than 10. I mean, it might be a couple of hundred now, and even in the wild. So, I mean, the good news is they're on the increase.
And are they on the increase on their own in the wild? Are the wild populations at this point actually increasing if you subtract the ones who are reintroduced now?
They are. And looking up on the Fish and Wildlife Service, this is the latest numbers. There are 160 California condors flying free in Central and Southern California, 80 condors in Arizona and Utah, 30 in Baja. So then count some more in Northern California, and it is a couple of hundred. So, and they're on the increase, as long as we don't, you know, keep going backwards, such as with renewable energy projects.
Okay, well, is there anything else that you want to say about the California condor at present?
Yeah, just briefly, to me, the condor represents this gigantic legacy of the past, the prehistoric past, a culturally important bird to native people in California, and it's just completely worthwhile to help recover this magnificent bird.
Well, thank you for all of that, and I would like to thank you, as always, for your great work in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Laura Cunningham. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you.